Welcome to the Core Principles Podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll enjoy this lively discussion of relevant topics, which we attempt to examine through the lens of unchanging, objective truth. Here's the host of the Core Principles Podcast, Clay Howerton.
Thank you, Suzanne. Today on Core Principles, I'm pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Tim Murphy. He served in the United States Navy Reserve, attaining the rank of commander. He was a state senator in Pennsylvania and an eight-term member of the United States House of Representatives. He's been assistant professor in the School of Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, as well as the School of Public Health. And he is founder and clinical director of Fortis Future. Welcome back to Core Principles, Dr. Tim Murphy. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing awesome. Great to be with you again. Thank you.
Well, today I want to talk with you about an article that you recently wrote for the American Spectator. It's called Gender Dysphoria in Kids. It's time for some serious research. Now, because this is a sensitive topic for a lot of folks, I want to start with a statement for the listeners. The things that Dr. Tim Murphy and I will discuss today and will say in our conversation are all messages of love. Truth is always consistent with love. God is truth and God is love. And love does not equate to telling each other only what we want to hear, nor affirming things that we know to be false. Neither Dr. Murphy nor I should be considered arbiters of truth, but hopefully we are tellers of truth. I know that's both of our objective. And again, God alone is the source of truth. So first question, Dr. Tim Murphy. Some people wish that those of us who refuse to affirm what we consider anti-reality would just keep our thoughts on such sensitive topics to ourselves. And they attempt to shut down these discussions with this kind of a question: why is this so important to you? So let me give you an opportunity to say why you consider the topic of gender dysphoria in kids an important one to speak about, and why you say it is time for some serious research.
It's important to me because I love children. I have a child, I have grandchildren, I'm around a lot of kids, and as people, we should all look out for the benefit of the next generation. And in the context of this, I know this is a growing concern. One hears about it on the news, from school board meetings, from legislators that are dealing with these issues. And I was recently at a conference, a psychological association conference, and I decided, you know, I need to learn something about this. So I hear a lot of talk. I had to find out about it for myself. And so in the context of that, I heard the presenter say, here's how you write a letter of support for someone to go through this gender-affirming surgery or change medical care. That up until this point, they felt children were not cared for. The children were dealing with gender dysphoria were problematic. And I should say, gender dysphoria is a medical psychological term that refers to a sense of unease. That's very important. It's not deep depression, overwhelming suicide. It's not schizophrenia and delusions. It's a sense of unease that a person may have because of a mismatch between their biological sex and their gender identity. So what their body has and what their head thinks. Now, that being the case, the presenters said, well, here's how you write this letter. And you note that the child or youth has these kind of concerns, these symptoms, how long it's lasting, that they want to be called by these pronouns. And the purpose of this is then to turn this over to medical providers to justify them doing a number of things. One, it may be giving a prepubescent child puberty blocker medication, prevent them from maturing. Two, postpubescent, to give that child medication to bring on the secondary characteristics. So a girl taking testosterone, a boy taking estrogen, and or three, surgical changes to actually make physical changes to their bodies. And what was really fascinating to me in a troubling way was the rationale they were given. And that is, they said that children who have these concerns are struggling with depression, anxiety, and a high suicide rate. And because there's a high suicide rate, as well as suicide attempts, the way to prevent that is to actually support them to go through these physical changes. The presenters even said, and again, this was one convention I went to, but this is standard within the practice of how they do this, was to say that because the risks for suicide are higher than any medical side effects for the hormones, it's worth it to save lives. I thought, well, okay, well, what are the side effects? Well, they're kind of minimal and they're temporary, they said, because they will wear off if they stop taking the medication. Do they stop taking the hormones? Well, no, they keep taking them. What are the side effects? They didn't elaborate. And I said, well, what is the effect after they go through this? Do they reduce suicide rates? Says, yes, the suicide rates plummet. I says, does depression go down? Yes. Well, so can you give me a citation on that? No, we don't have that. Well, I said, why was there such a big increase in this in the last 5 years, where it was a fraction of 1% a few years ago, and now they say it's closer to 2% of kids? Well, that's a massive increase, massive. And I say, you always have to look at what else was happening during that time. Now, we remember the COVID lockdown. And when kids were pushed out of schools, they lost their social interaction, which is vitally important for children and adolescents. And during that time, we saw big increased rates of anxiety and depression. So now adolescents and young adults, 18 to 24 is the young adults and adolescents, the rates of symptoms they have of depression and anxiety is almost 50%. It's massive. Well, why is that? Well, it isn't that it's all about gender dysphoria. We have a huge number of kids who dropped out of school, a huge number of kids with absentee rates, a huge number of kids who spent a lot of that time going on TikTok and Instagram to self-diagnose all their problems. There's more social pressure and push to look at these things and questions about bathrooms. And you can't go through anything without children hearing this message. And then you have a lot of incredibly misinformed school boards, local elected officials, and state officials who quite simply don't know what they're talking about. They're given information on this. They think, well, we better pass laws to allow all this. So there's this storm of misinformation on this, and kids are caught up in this storm. And I'm deeply worried that if we don't press pause and really look hard at the science, we'll be doing a lot of permanent damage to children.
Permanent is a key word there, Dr. Tim Murphy. There's a whole lot to dig into. We'll look at some of these things you've brought up during the course of our discussion. I want to mention a couple of things. They seem like sidelights, but you talked about the lockdowns. Listeners, be on guard for an attempt to reimpose COVID restrictions. Don't fall for that again, please. Even the CDC has acknowledged they finally figured it was over, so they acknowledge that the masks never worked. Please don't fall for that ploy again. And if they try to lock you down again, please don't despair. That was never the solution to an airborne virus. Regardless, getting back to what you mentioned about the messaging that they're hearing, I just saw today, Dr. Murphy, a picture of a teacher, I think a first grade teacher, wearing a shirt that said, "Educating is activism." And she was distressed because she had a progressive LGBTQ plus flag that her superiors at the school made her take down. And she thought, well, this is terrible. It's not safe for me now because they won't let me indoctrinate these children, which is my job. And I thought, well, that's really not your job. But that is happening with school boards. Well, you talked about the suicidal ideation. And in your article, Gender Dysphoria in Kids, Time for Serious Research, you noted that 82% of youth who have dysphoria have suicidal thoughts, and that 40% make attempts. That's really staggering and terrifying to me. I'm not a medical professional, but I find the surgical approach illogical. Can you help me better understand why there's such a push for surgical alteration of young bodies?
So a few years ago, there was some physicians, I think it was the Boston area, that said, maybe with children who are struggling with this, and I don't doubt that there's children who are struggling with this. There are. But maybe what we ought to do is actually perform surgery to make boys into girls and girls into boys physically, so their body matches what their thoughts are. And they reported that some people were doing better than that, just as they thought some adults were. Well, this began to spread. Now, I have my suspicions. There's a lot of profit in this, in the medications and in the surgical changes. But is this good for kids? But the suicide issue is what's pushed. And let me explain something, though. A lot of these suicide studies will say, gee, during the time that we began talking with the kid, here's what they do. They provide counseling for them. They immediately will get the child to be part of their new peer group or people from the LGBTQ community. So they'll be very supportive. They'll surround this person, child or adult, with like-minded thinkers. They'll work with the parents. If the parents agree, they'll support them. If the parents disagree, they push them out. They even had on there that they will work with kids to counsel them against the transphobia of religion. So they'll pull religion away from their life. So what they're doing is they're changing their social network. They're providing counseling. They're doing all these things. So then if they start the hormones and everything else, they say, oh, look, the suicide risk has gone down. Well, if you take someone who's teased and bullied and struggling and surround them with positive peer groups and positive counseling and other care, they're going to get better anyways. But one has to look at these studies and say, well, did you do a control group? Control group, if you randomly take kids, and some kids get the supports, some kids get nothing, and some kids get the full surgery and hormones, et cetera, and compare them, you might have a better sense. Well, here's the thing. Those studies have not been done. They've been done on a very limited basis, but you really have to look at them for years. 8 to 10 years is generally the measure that's used. So they'll say suicide rates would decline. But then again, how do you also separate that from all the depression and anxiety that's there in the post-COVID era, when kids' lives were totally disrupted and so much of their lives are run by what I mentioned before about the self-diagnosis that comes from these areas too. Well, there's another study that's recent that came out that was a longitudinal study, looked at 42 years worth of data. This was out of Denmark. And what they said is those who are transgender, not those who are kids thinking about it, those who are transgender, have a 3.5 times higher rate of suicide death and a 7 times higher rate of suicide attempts. Now, that's attempts, not just thinking about it. So if this was really good for kids, then how do you have these issues? That's a massive increase. Well, there's a number of factors there. One is just reading another study that says when you have depression or personality disorders or other things intermixed with this, this thing called used to be written about 15, 20 years ago as this body dysphoria, where you feel you just didn't like your body, that if you had depression or other things, it didn't matter how much plastic surgery you had, you weren't going to be happy. Well, some other studies have been done recently, and these are ones that these groups hang on to say, oh, look, at the workshop I went to, they said it was a 97% satisfaction rate. Another one said it's 99.7% satisfaction. So I thought, that seems odd. I mean, if a person goes to the dentist because they've got a toothache and the dentist works on it, I don't think you get 99% satisfaction with that. So I began to look at other studies about plastic surgery. They're just body enhancer, whatever they do to make someone look better. Well, it turns out those aren't at 99%. Some are at 90, some in their 80s. But those are someone who's doing things to make their face look better. You know, they get their nose or their eyes or some surgery done there. But to say these numbers there, I thought, well, what is it? Well, I looked at these studies. There was no control group. They followed a group of people for, I think it was a 14-month study they did. They 1,989 people. During this time, only 6 people wanted reversal surgery. And those are the ones they called regret. Regret was only if you actually sought to have reversal surgery. So I said, well, let's think about that. The study also said that, well, they reported that there was people who were grieving their changes, but they didn't call those regrets. They called those grieving. They didn't do testing to see, well, how many people are depressed, who's on antidepressant medication, who's had other changes in their life, do they still have their support groups? And what this practice in this article said is, oh, we surround them with lots of support. We do all these things for them. Well, if you're doing all these things, why do you think surgery was the only thing that made the change? But here's the thing. If you want to go through a reversal, that's very expensive. And people don't have the money. And there's cases now where people are actually suing their psychologists and their physicians saying, wait, I went through this as a kid, and now I have all these expenses because I want to go back. There's a case of a a boy turned girl, or vice versa. And now they have to go back and have surgery to change things back. But this is a girl who had a radical double mastectomy. She says, I can't be a woman now. I can't do the same things because of the hormones. She thinks she can't have babies now. She has to have her whiskers and things removed. Well, insurance is going to pay for that. So who has the money? So one has to look at all these things, but follow up someone really for years, 8 to 10 years. I don't doubt that there's people like this, but the question is, should we be letting children make these decisions? And what I find is there's adults around, like the teacher you mentioned, others, who it's their own issues. They almost get giddy about, oh, I'm going to raise children with this. I'm going to teach them about these things and forget about their main mission is to teach children to read and write and develop their critical thinking skills so they make decisions.
Absolutely. I saw another, this has been months ago, a teacher bragging online that for her, either, I guess, kindergarten class, that every single kindergartner in her class had come to her independently and told her 100%, I am something other than they actually were biologically. They didn't think about that themselves. She encouraged them, you probably are, and she got 100% of them to say, sure, I am. That's not educating, that's indoctrinating.
There's a famous quote some years ago that children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them. So if a child sees that adult acting a certain way, they'll act that too, because kids want to identify with adults. They want to be bigger. And at that age, you know, boys will play with dolls and girls will play with trucks or baseballs. That's not the gender identity issue. That's just kids playing and exploring. That's no big deal. But adults read into these things because of their own issues. And when they read into that, they run the danger of that. I mean, look, there's something that's fascinating this too, and that is, as you know, something else I wrote in the article about just the developing brain. Teachers study courses on understanding brain development, and somehow, maybe in the last couple of years, they forgot all that. And there's pressure on us as psychologists to say, ignore all that data about the brain. Here's what happens. The brain develops first in the more primitive areas with our emotions and our feelings. It makes sense because we have to be able to react to fearful and stressful situations. And particularly a part of the brain called the amygdala, the fight or flight center of the brain. That's what kids need to know, run from fearful things or fight them. That part of the brain, the whole limbic system with the emotional part of the brain, continues to dominate really right up until about the mid-20s. By age 25, the frontal lobe, the frontal cortex, the front part of our brain, which is the center of reasoning, problem solving, logical thinking, planning, delaying gratification for the future, all those things, that doesn't become dominant until someone's in the mid-20s. So what does that mean? That means children and adolescents are more influenced by peers, by the whims of the time, by their emotions. I mean, everybody knows the struggles of, you know, the breakup with the first girlfriend or boyfriend, the feeling that other kids are teasing them, the bullying, all those things really cut to the quick for children, and they get very upset over things, and parents say, that's okay, it's part of growing up, you'll get over it, that's okay, which is what we should be telling kids. But now they're telling kids, oh, well, you if you're distressed and you're 10, maybe you really are a girl, maybe you really are a boy, let's explore that. And the kids are thinking, well, maybe I am, I don't know, I've got to find a reason. So they plant these seeds in people, indoctrinate that into kids when the mind isn't even capable. I mean, look at the things we know legally. Kids can't drive a car till they're 16. Age of consent is 16 in many states. The 18 to join the military, to vote, to own a gun, to 21 to drink. The list goes on and on. And even the courts know there's different standards for keep people under 18 than above, whatever the crime is. But how is it that we say you're not held responsible for a crime? You can't drink. They don't even want you seeing vaping commercials. You can't vote, all those things. But we're going to let you at age 5 or 6 decide your gender. It is preposterous. And what it means is let's ignore the development of the brain. And this is where the courts, thank goodness, the courts still know what many of these teachers and medical professionals refuse to acknowledge. Now, when that falls by the wayside, when the court starts saying, well, anybody can decide at any age, then scrap the entire legal system. Says, okay, well, if a five-year-old goes into a store and steals candy, we're giving you the full force of the law in terms of shoplifting. You're no longer excused for that anymore. That all that logically goes with that. So we have to be very, very careful where all this is going through this.
Indeed, and that age of consent in context becomes more stark now, as you talk about all of that going by the wayside. There are those who would want that. I watched Sound of Freedom. It's just the most horrifying thing ever. The discussion you were giving there about the frontal lobe and the reasoning centers, it's a great idea that Vivek Ramaswamy had. He's running for president. He said, let's make the voting age 25. Maybe there's something to that. Well, you talk in your article about errors in medical studies and in clinical settings. And I know we want to trust medical professionals. We want to trust our doctors. But I also know, without contradiction, that second opinions are often advised, and for good reason. No one is infallible, and the entire medical community can sometimes permit outrageously wrong conclusions to be published as if they're valid. And one example comes to mind is that medical journals published peer-reviewed declarations that opioids were not addictive. And we see the result of that. If you want more information, listeners, read the book Dreamland. It is absolutely terrifying, but it shows how certain unrelated things ballooned into the opioid crisis. And that was one of them, the idea medically that they weren't addictive if they were taken properly. Well, how, Dr. Tim Murphy, do we, people like myself, just lay people, best discern what is trustworthy in these current medical viewpoints?
Well, you're giving a great example, the opioid crisis. And I remember at that time people coming to my office from pharmaceutical companies saying, you know, the studies show us that, actually they said, according to the New England Journal of Medicine, we know these opioids are not addictive. Well, quite frankly, I didn't check into that. I should have said, I want to see that study. And a lot of other people who are legislators, et cetera, also didn't say that. And quite frankly, a lot of people in the medical profession didn't say, I want to see that study. As it turns out, whatever he was quoting was not a peer-reviewed article, but was a letter to the editor that was published in the Wall Street Journal, in the New England Journal of Medicine. And in that, they were referencing, someone did a group of people and said, as they gave them those opioids, they were not addicted. But here's what also has happened. It also led to this whole movement of, we have the vital signs, it's heart rate, temperature, respiratory rate, what am I missing here?
Pulse. And now pain.
Then they made pain there too. And the way pain was measured on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in? Or if you don't know the number, point to the emoji from a happy face to a very grimacing face. I was in a rollover accident in Iraq in 2005 or 3, and I got to see this firsthand. That what happened was, immediately people said to me, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much pain are you in? Actually, they do a mental status exam. What is your name? Where are you located right now? Who's the president of the United States? Last four digits, social security number. What? They do all these things to see, are you aware and conscious? And on a scale of 1 to 10, what is your pain level? I was in a lot of pain. So I said 7 and 8. They would give me morphine for the pain. And what happened was, by the time I came back from Iraq to the United States, I was on OxyContin, fentanyl, Tylenol, and then was receiving injections in my neck and spine to reduce the pain. So this was going on for about 30 days, and finally I said, I can't think anymore. I can't function. I stopped everything cold turkey. I had some level of withdrawal reaction, but I never went back to those things. But it was all under that message of the pain. As it turns out, that was a big lie, that people were going along with it and never questioning. And that's a big danger in science. But here's another thing. There also becomes a movement to attack those who are questioning. So we saw during that time, they would attack physicians, says, no, I don't want to bring people hooked on this. And during COVID, they would attack those who said, wait a minute, we don't have the data. The masks are not doing this. Remember they said, don't go outside. And now we say, actually, being outside would have been the best thing for everybody. Go out to your local park. Don't have physical contact with people, but go out and be in the sunshine. And now with this as well, people aren't reading the original studies and seeing the flaws in them. There's also legal attacks taking place because depending upon the state you're in some cases it's illegal. They're criminalizing parenthood. So in some states, if a parent encourages their child to have these surgeons and hormone shots, states like Texas, it needs to be reported as child abuse. And what I see among psychologists say, well, I don't think you should report that. Don't pay attention to law. That's good civil disobedience. If the parents are supporting the child to go through this, be there. In other states, they criminalize it if the parents do try and block it. So Maine, New Jersey, Oregon, Washington, California, Minnesota are all either passed or looking at laws as saying parents may not interfere with this. California even looking at a law that at age 12, child can say, I don't like my parents. I want to go into a different home. Well, how do you have states with two entirely different contradictory laws? It's because it's a mess. They're not looking at research. And the opponents to, or the ones who support the trans research, trans actions for children, are saying, well, these are just bad conservative people, or they're hyper-religious, and they're not looking at the data. So I say, all right, let's look at the objective data. Show me the studies. And this is where it falls apart. So it's all that, but this is where bad science makes bad laws and creates huge problems. If I can put in one more story in this too, there was a time when, was it in the 80s or 90s, there was this whole movement about suppressed memories and figuring that people who were maybe in their 20s and 30s and struggling, they probably had some suppressed memory. They had amnesia for maybe being abused when they were a kid. And so they would talk to the people about this as, well, you must have some memories that are just hidden in there. And the next thing you know, some people actually then filed criminal complaints against a parent or relatives as, well, this must be the person who did this to me. And then there's criminal charges put up against someone. Well, as it turns out, that was false. People's lives were ruined from that. But this idea that you could have a suppressed memory, that you have no memory at all, but people had charges filed against them, led to huge problems. There was also, I don't remember, years ago, there was this thing about red M&Ms caused hyperactivity.
I remember.
So M&Ms company took all the red candies, all the red M&Ms, all the red dye number two taken out. Well, that was nonsense as well. There was the move that says mercury in inoculations caused autism. Well, that wasn't the case because we haven't had that for years in there. There's other things contributing to that. But we go through these fads, and I look at it and says, well, if mutilating the body or damaging the body is a way to help people through their depression or anxiety, look at other types of body dysmorphia. What about women and men who have bulimia or anorexia, and they figure, yeah, I feel overweight at 90 pounds. I need to lose more. What about those who feel better if they cut themselves repeatedly? The cutting, do we allow that to happen? What about those now who actually feel they identify with someone with a disability? So they want to be blinded or have an arm or leg removed or fingers removed because then they say, I feel better because I don't like my arm. This is how absurd this goes. And I'm not making these stories up. They are there. And this is where we have to get back to the science. And those who are mental health professionals have to stop just going along with this and really question what is the best interest of the patient.
Indeed. And you can see it just would never end. Maybe I need different pigmentation of my skin, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in your article, Dr. Tim Murphy, about how we need some serious research, you highlight some flaws that you see in current studies. Could you summarize briefly what you consider the main flaws in the current studies, other than that there's too few of them, some of the logical flaws or other flaws in the studies that people are relying on right now regarding gender dysphoria?
Sure. There's been an explosion of studies in the last 5 years as interest has grown. So as the interest has grown, these studies are coming out, but none of them have an opportunity to look at it long enough. So one is you have to look at a longitudinal factor, and that means at least 8 to 10 years to see what the effect is. When you have someone who may have had something done at age 10 or 12 or 5, you cannot ask that person a year or two from now, are you happy with the way things are going? So you have to go much, much longer. That's one thing. A second thing, you need to use more than just screening tests. A lot of these studies will use a 9-item screening test to look and see if the person is depressed, or 7-item screening test if they're anxious. That's called the General Anxiety Disorder 7, the GAD-7 screening test. That is only designed for when you're going to see your doctor to check it off, and then the doctor says, you have a high score for your age. We need to refer you to someone to get something more in depth. If you were to take a simple measure of and ask a question before you go to the dentist, have you ever had any tooth pain? Yes, I have. Okay, well, then we better start removing your teeth or start putting fillings in. No, that simply says you have that. Let's do other tests. What some studies have done is taken that little screening test, and they say, well, from time A at the beginning, and then we did this intervention, time B, we see a reduction in improvement in the score in this anxiety test. But here's the facts. Besides, it's just a screening test. Three or four items on that test use the word worry. I worry a lot every day. I have significant worries. And as soon as a person's worry is going down, they're going to improve dramatically on that test, on that screening measure. I shouldn't even call it a test. So that's part of it. So you have to go back and look at the original data. But here's another thing. They don't follow up with more in-depth tests. In fact, at the conference I went to, although they did say that people should have you should evaluate for psychosis and autism and personality disorders and severe depression and all these other things, someone said, well, can I use these standard psychological tests? One of them is called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, or other ones. And the reaction came, no, I don't use tests. I just interview them and I take their word for it. Or someone else says, well, if you use tests like that, you're pathologizing their relationship, or you're having a power struggle between the doctor and patient. I'm thinking, wait. The idea is you have to have some clinically research objective measure. When one has a full psychological test, there's massive numbers of studies looking at thousands and thousands of people that not only do you have the test results, but then they go back and interview the person and say, well, according to these results, does that match with what I see as a clinician? Well, these studies don't do that. They give a little screening test, say, oh, look, there's improvement, and that's it. Those are inadequate. But there's also, they're not looking at the other access that people have to counseling, the other supports they get. And that study I mentioned before about regrets, you know what they don't do? They don't go to the patient and say, do you have any regrets? Do you wish you had not done this? Do you wish you had held off on this? Is there any concerns you have? So if you don't ask, you don't get the answers. They don't look to see, could a person not afford treatment? And here's another factor too. If the doctor who did your surgery is the one asking the question, are you happy with it? People don't tell the truth. Something like 40% of people don't tell the doctor the truth. We've all done, you have some symptoms, you go to the doctor says, is there anything else? No, I'm good. You don't want to be identified with these problems too. So people don't always tell the truth. So a lot of research flaws in all these studies.
Well, just before we wrap up, I did want to touch back on the legislative aspect of it to conclude. But first, Dr. Tim Murphy, I wanted to ask you about this one other thing. It's a little bit off the path, but directly related, I think. I notice a trend towards rendering well-understood words meaningless. This seemingly ridiculous question, what is a woman, has become so pervasive that even a Supreme Court justice balked at that question, saying that she couldn't possibly understand the term woman because she's not a biologist. I think the destruction of obvious meanings of common words is a trick to suppress discussion of topics. Am I wrong about that? And if not, is there a solution we can pursue that important discussions resume?
Well, at the risk of sounding like a conspiracy theorist, because that's what oftentimes we're reduced to, when you start to talk about facts and objectivity, people attack you personally. But here's the thing. I ask people if they've ever read George Orwell's book, 1984, where they talked about doublespeak. War is peace. You know, poverty is wealth, all those things. Obedience is freedom. And by using words and flipping them around, you make them meaningless and very manipulable. So if a Supreme Court justice cannot define what a woman is, says, well, then how can you define what legal is? Can you define what is constitutional? Well, it depends what the meaning of is. So there's serious problems with that. Words are also manipulated with this group too. And this is more evidence I see that people understand the kids' minds aren't there. But instead of referring to some of these surgeries for what they are, they'll use benign words. So if a girl is going to have, because she's thinking, I'm really a boy, I don't want to grow breasts, they'll give this girl a radical double mastectomy, but they'll call it top. We'll fix your top. And for a boy to castrate, or for a girl to have a hysterectomy as an adolescent or something, they'll refer to that as bottom. And The picture I saw that they'll show these kids actually has a picture of a unicorn and a smiling unicorn. Well, why would you need to have something that looks like that's out of a coloring book to match it? Well, because it has to match the kid's age, which means they're immature. So we've manipulated words. We attack on words. People don't want to discuss facts, and they'll attack the person too. It's very troublesome because it goes back to what you started out. This is an act of love, but love needs to be based upon truth. We're losing what truth is and attacking people for speaking the truth, attacking the messenger. And I worry because we're reaching this tipping point where will there be those who continue to speak out? A great quote that I think came out of World War II and fighting the Nazis was that they came after the socialists. I wasn't a socialist, so I said nothing. Then they came after whatever the other groups were, the workers, the party members, the Catholics, whatever it is. And then they came after me and there was no one else left. We are at that level too, where they're attacking physicians, they're attacking mental health providers, they're attacking people by their faith and building up on that. So unfortunately, a lot of people are silent. So in the context of this, it's very valuable. My advice to parents, number one, love your children. Number two, don't be satisfied when someone gives you information that doesn't make sense. Go research. Number three, speak up to school boards, to legislators, whatever. Don't be silent about it. Remember, the letter you never write is a letter that's never read. And hold those elected officials accountable because they're taking information that's faddish, that's F-A-D-D-I-S-H, and they're taking information that's false and treating it as true, and the harm is permanent.
So important. Words have meaning, and we have to hold on to the commonly understood meaning or else communication breaks down. And when you talk about Orwell's newspeak and doublespeak, you brought to mind a German phrase. You're talking about, hate is love, love is hate, war is peace, et cetera, et cetera. Here's one in German, Arbeit macht frei. And you've probably never heard that, listeners. It translates work makes free. And it's on the entry to Auschwitz. That's the significance of destroying language.
And I think it was within Goebbels that said, if you tell a lie often enough, eventually people will believe it.
Indeed. Indeed. And don't think it can't happen here, listeners, because in the 30s in the United States, there were a lot of people within the judicial system pushing ideas over and over that had nothing to do with the Constitution, and they had a philosophy that said, there is nothing so ridiculous that if you repeat it often enough, people will start to believe it. Well, finally, Dr. Tim Murphy, what counsel or advice would you offer for legislators at either the state or federal level regarding how they might best address these issues? You talked a little bit about how different states are taking polar opposite, completely incompatible approaches. Do legislators have a role in this, and what is their best course of action?
Well, we like to think that it's like what kids used to be taught about, I'm a bill on the hill and here's how a bill becomes law. But what happens is it's very influenced by the parties and by what the people are taught and by what they think their voters want. It takes courage for a legislator to say, wait a minute, I want to read the research on this. I want to know. And quite frankly, that has to do with whether or not the president is saying, let's vote on war or building a highway or whatever it is. Know the data. And many times legislators are not reading that. I strongly encourage them, get back, know the facts on this, and be willing to have the courage to say, not here, not on this. This isn't the place to do this. Maybe different with adults who are 18 or 21 and can make choices in their lives. But with children, it is the responsibility of legislative bodies to protect them from this and not follow the whims of the moment. But you have to read it. It takes work. And ask questions, and don't just go with those who are the most vocal or the most angry, but really be thoughtful and persistent on this.
Amen. Wise counsel. So reject the Pelosi model of let's pass it first, and then we can understand what's in it. That's not the way legislators.
Or the emotional model. I feel this way. As I said earlier, bad science makes bad legislation, and you can look at. Even when our Constitution was first written, there was mistakes made because people had feelings that they didn't want to buck up against, that a black person, a slave, was had less value to be counted than a white person. Or women weren't valued at that time, so we weren't going to let them vote. We realize There's no facts behind that. And so we've changed those to fit the facts, but we can't change the facts to fit our opinion. As the, what's that famous quote? You're entitled to your opinion, but not your own facts. So study this carefully.
Yes.
And that's part of it. So
one comment regarding that three-fifths compromise in the Constitution, it does sound horrifically offensive. However, I open to the possibility that that was a trick by the opponents of slavery to say that we're going to make states that don't abolish it right away have less of a say. And ultimately that helped get rid of the horrible practice of slavery. We weren't there. We don't know exactly what was on their hearts, but that is one possibility. Well, thank you very much for being my guest again on Core Principles, Dr. Tim Murphy. God bless you.
Thank you very much. I might say if people have other comments or questions for me, I have a website, which is drtimmurphy.com. That's drtimmurphy.com. And where I continue to do some of my own podcasts and thoughts and writings on faith and mental health and bringing them together to enlighten people.
Outstanding. And also, listeners, pick up a copy and read and share The Christ Cure by Dr. Tim Murphy. I interviewed him about that previously. It's a very valuable resource. And take care. Have a blessed day.
Thank you. God bless.
Core Principles Podcast is produced in Paducah, Kentucky by Real Productions. Music is by Late July, L-E-I-G-H-T July. You can find our music on all streaming services or at latejuly.com. Thank you for joining us today for this episode of the Core Principles Podcast. Please visit core.buzzsprout.com for more information. And please share with your friends. We look forward to visiting with you again on our next episode.